that Abu Akleh had been deliberately targeted by the Zionist regime forces. While the killing sparked significant international condemnation, it was hardly an isolated incident. According to the UN report, last year was the deadliest for Palestinians in the West Bank since the end of the Second Intifada in early 2000s. This year is on track to be worse, as Israeli regime forces make military incursions into cities like Nablus and Jenin with increasing frequency. According to the UN, Israeli regime forces have already killed at least 94 Palestinians this year, including at least 19 children, more than double last year's number in the same period. As The Intercept reported last year, the US government never investigated the Zionist regime's killing of 23-year-old peace activist Rachel Corrie, who was crushed to death with a bulldozer while protesting a home demolition in Gaza 20 years ago, nor of 78-year-old Omar Assad, a former Milwaukee grocery store owner who died of a heart attack last year while in custody of a notoriously violent Israeli regime military unit. The U.S. Justice Department's investigation into Abu Akleh's death, which came only after serious outrage at U.S. inaction in the case, marked the first time the U.S. government moved to independently probe the Zionist regime's killing of an American. As a standard with criminal investigations by the FBI, Justice Department officials have not spoken publicly about the case. The Justice Department did not respond to a request for comment. Abu Akleh was not the first journalist killed by Zionist regime forces. In a report published recently, the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, documented at least 20 instances of Israeli forces killing members of the media since 2001. Like Abu Akleh, the majority of those killed, at least 13, were clearly identified as journalists or inside vehicles with press in Sinai when they were killed, according to the report. Many more journalists were injured by Zionist regime forces, which also repeatedly targeted media headquarters. During a military assault on Gaza in 2021, for instance, the Israeli regime bombed buildings where more than a dozen local and international media outlets were headquartered, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. As The Intercept has previously reported, the Zionist regime also regularly detains and questions Palestinian journalists, including 16, who are currently being held without charges. To be a journalist in Palestine is a very dangerous job, said Ammar Al-Duaik, the director of the Independent Commission for Human Rights, Palestine's National Human Rights Institute, adding that journalists also face daily intimidation by Zionist settlers and troops. Al-Duaik, who was a colleague of Abu Akleh, said that her killing was a reminder that nobody was safe from Israeli regime violence and that journalists were no exception. He said Shirin was visible in the broad daylight. The troops could see her wearing the vest and yet they shot her, which means that no one is safe and everyone could be a target. Being a journalist doesn't give you any protection with Israeli troops. Nor has being a clearly identifiable journalist led to greater accountability.
Sheikh Baghir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahruddin was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, Al Muallim. This program is about the life and the works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars and ulama all across the world during the history of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding maraje and fuqaha of the 13th and the 14th century Hijra, and one of the special students of Akhund al-Khurasani, who reached the status of marja'iyya and the general custodianship of the Islamic houses of Najaf in Iraq, Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Isfahani, one of the most outstanding and exceptional characters of contemporary houses in Iran and Iraq. Sheikh Rouhani, give us some information about the early life of Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Isfahani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatullah Sayyid Abu al-Hasan Isfahani was born in 1284 Hijri Qamari. He lived in Isfahan and Najaf al-Ashraf, in these two main Shiite cities at that time. And of course, he was buried in the holy shrine of Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wassalam and died in 1365. Among his scholars, we can mention some of the great names like Mirza Habibullah Rashti, Akhund Khorasani, and Mirza Muhammad Hassani Shirazi. Each one of them is one of the great scholars of Tashayyu in the 14th century. And among the students of this great scholar, again, there are very great names. Among them is Sayyid Muhsin Hakim,
yes,
Muhammad Kuhistani Mazandarani, and Sayyid, yes, Muhammad Hadi Milani, which is really, and also Sayyid Muhammad Hussain Tabatabai. You see that all of them are,
yes,
we can say, the greatest, among the greatest scholars of the Shayyu. Of course, among his works, we can mention some of the names and the titles of his books, like Wasilatul Najat, and which is a kind of commentary on, yes, Urwatul Wuthqa. And also he has a commentary on Tafsiratul Muta'allimin. He was, of course, a marja'i taqlid in his,
yes,
time. And in his, let's say, socio-political aspect of his life, you can mention that, yeah, mm-hmm, he supported the constitutionalism in Iran.
Yes.
And, of course, he supported this kind of political movement.
That's right.
And kind of reforms in the political areas in Iran and also in Iraq. He was also opposed and against the invasion of Iraq at that time, which could be mentioned as some of his main political activities in his life.
That's all right. Especially the book Wasilatul Najat was very much considered by the following generations. For example, the late Imam Khomeini, they say that his book Tahrirul Wasila is based on Wasilatul Najat. So let's be a little bit concerned about his life as a marja, different experiences, I mean, religiously speaking and scholarly speaking, that he passed in order to reach the status of marja'iyya in Iraq.
You know, he, first of all, he lived in Iran, in Isfahan. And because at that time, the Hoza, the main center of Hoza, was in Najaf. But at that time, people who started to study in Hoza, if they want to grow to the highest level of Hoza, they had to migrate to Iraq and go to Najaf. So like other great scholars of Islam and Shia, after passing some grades in Iran, elementary levels of Hoza, he decided to migrate to Najaf. At the beginning, his father disagreed that, and the father doesn't like his son to leave the country, leave the city and go there, because maybe he knew that if he go to other country, he won't get back. He tried a lot to convince his father, and he started this journey. The journey was so hard, and he had to walk a lot of ways, roads of the journey. But anyway, he could reach to the city of Najaf and continue his study. That's a great lesson for our generation, for youth. Although we have a lot of technologies, convenience nowadays, maybe some youth don't want to continue their study and grow in the levels of science. Always we think about entertainment, about having an easy life, which is not the duty of humans. If we want to have a good social life, we have to try, we have to do our best in order to grow in our knowledge. Not just person, even a country, a government, if it wants to grow, it has to grow and improve in knowledge. So we can get this lesson from our scholars. You know, leaving your country is not easy. Leaving your family and... as you know, journey at that time was not easy. It was not any flight. It was not cars. You had to go with the camels or maybe sometimes like him on foot.
Yes.
So it is so hard. He did that. Mm-hmm. And you can see the conclusion. He could be one of the greatest scholars. And not just in Hosea, even in socio-political actions, he could be a leader like, I don't know, supporting the revolution, Thawra al-Ashreen.
Yes, yes.
And he supported that, and he gave a fatwa in order to support that, in order to save Islam and save Islamic countries, in order to oppose the colonialism.
Yes.
So that is the result of that hardship. Mm-hmm. If he didn't do that, he couldn't be a leader in knowledge, in politics, and as well.
That's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, let's get now to his main outstanding work, magnum opus, we say in English, we can't say Vasilatun Najat. What is this book exactly? We said that so many commentaries have been written on this book, especially Tahrir Vasila by the late Imam Khomeini. Let's be a little bit concerned with Vasilatun Najat.
Yes, Vasilatun Najat, as it is known as from its name, its title is very nice, Vasilatun Najat. You know, in
the
Islamic,
means for salvation.
Yeah, salvation,
huh?
Yes. To achieve a kind of prosperous life or to save yourself against hellfire.
Yes.
So there is a wasila, there is a mean by which you can save yourself. So that is why wasila to najat means that if you follow, if you observe the jurisprudential rulings in your life, it helps you to save yourself from the hellfire. So that's why the title is really nice, really beautiful, that is chosen by Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. But the other important point is that, of course, after Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, the other great Shia scholars tried to make use of this method.
Yes.
And actually their risala, their jurisprudential works were a kind of commentary which were related to this work of Allama Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. We can mention the name
so
of...
So we can say that most of the Risala or Tawzih al-Masail of the modern generation of the ulama are based on Tahrir.
Are based on this, yes.
Okay.
And this Wasilatun Najat, like Tahrir al-Wasila of Imam al-Khumayni, rahmatullahi alayhi, was also based on this Wasilatun Najat of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. And of course, it becomes like a kind of original source for Risala or for jurisprudential works of the Shiite scholars after Ayatollah Abul Hassan Isfahani.
They call it ta'liqa, isn't it?
Exactly,
It's a kind of commentary, I think.
Yes, it's commentary.
Or marginal writings, that's right.
Exactly.
Okay, that's all right.
One of the important points in his life, Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani's life, was to he supported other Islamic scholars. And it was a method of life among our scholars. They didn't used to live alone for themselves and not to care about other Islamic scholars. At that time, at his time, their best regime of Iraq, they sent one of the scholars, Ayatollah Khalisi, to exile. They sent him to Saudi Arabia at that time in order not to be in power in Iraq. And then Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, in order to oppose this action,
yes,
he migrated again to Iran. So mm-hmm. It was not good for the regime because it could make people to go toward a revolution. And after a while, the regime decided to make Ayatollah Khalisi back,
yes,
to bring him back. Of course, they sent Ayatollah Khalisi to Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it was a defeat for that regime. After Ayatollah Khalisi came back to Iran, again, Ayatollah Abul Hassan Isfahani went to Iraq and Najaf. That is the power that our scholar has all the time. You know, if you are really a scientist in Islam and if you care about people's life, people will support you,
yes,
and you can be in the center of power.
Mm-hmm.
And you should use your power in the way of haq, mm-hmm, not for yourself. And again, another point in his life that we can focus on that is the ambassador of Britain at that time, they gave some money by check to him,
yes,
and maybe they thought that by giving this money we can overcome the Marjaiya, mm-hmm, of Shia, so we can colonize Marjaiya, mm-hmm, as we colonize the countries. But he kept that money and used it for people, the people who were damaged in the war,
yes,
and the attacks of Britain.
Yes.
And and when the ambassador understood that the money was not used for himself, the money was used for people, the ambassador said, we wanted to defeat him, but mm-hmm, he did it for us. Now, yes, he is in power, mm-hmm, more than us because, yes, people know that he supports him. And of course, he added some money to that check. So this is our scholar. They, yes, don't gather money for themselves.
Yes.
They try to gather money, yes, mm-hmm, but it is managing money,
that's
not
right,
gathering money for ourselves.
Yes.
So they manage the money to use it for people, to, yes, their convenience.
Especially the students or tullab of the Islamic seminaries, yeah, you know, Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani was really after their, we can say, that's right, needs, financial needs. They say that the letters that were sent to him was read out by Sayyid Abul Hassan and they were torn away. So maybe not, for example, not a disgrace or, we can say, a trace of disgrace for over there. One outstanding and shocking story about his life is that a person killed his son.
Yeah.
And he forgives the murderer of his son. You know, this is really a big lesson for some of us. That's right. A person gets to the Holy Shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam after Namaz al-Salat al-Jama'ah. He kills the son of Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani, but after some days, we can say he could do qisas or something like that, but he forgives the killer of his son.
Although he was in charge of Huza.
Yeah,
he
was
power
in charge of.
He could do anything.
Yeah, yeah, he got the power.
He didn't have to,
yes,
forgive.
Yes, yes. He was in power. Ayatollah Behjat, in a handwritten letter, has narrated the late Isfahani, his fatwa against tatbir.
Yeah.
I mean, beating oneself and struggling, to, we can say, with a dagger or something for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And these were all the socio-political and the religio-cultural struggles of the late Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani.
Even because of his fatwa,
yes,
against tatbir, some of his mughalids,
yes,
they rejected, mm-hmm, his position of marjaiya and, mm-hmm, they stopped to follow him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is ignorance. This,
yes,
is they say, what we call it, jahiliya.
Yes,
you follow,
right,
someone and a scholar as your marja, and because you don't like his fatwa, you change your,
yes,
taglid.
That's right. Okay, thank you much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani. Zilhajjah 9, 1365, according to the Hijra calendar, he passed away. His body was taken from Al-Kazamiyah to the holy city of Najaf and was buried in one of the chambers around the holy shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So many people attended the burial session and the ceremony of the late Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani, up to an extent that they say that this presence overwhelmed the Democrat activities in Azerbaijan, in Iran. So it somehow it overshadowed, we could say, or as an umbrella term, that activities over there. And this is the life of the great men of Allah. You know, both their birth and death are the blessing for the Muslim lands. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher on the Life of Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani, the author of Vasilatul Najat. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanah.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The EU Commission admitted the core inflation rate in the Eurozone, which analysts say is directly linked to sanctions against Russia, remains stubbornly high. This hits people's purchasing power, especially in lower and middle-income groups, and hurts the competitiveness of EU companies. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV reported protests in Europe are continuing unabated. Recently, thousands of teachers and healthcare professionals took to the streets in the Spanish capital, Madrid, demanding better pay and working conditions. This can be seen in other parts of Europe, like the UK and France. Britain has found itself grappling with the worst cost of living crisis in decades. Inflation is at a 41-year high, and food and energy bills have skyrocketed. In the last few months in particular, millions are struggling to cope. Throughout Europe, the ruling classes are claiming that they cannot make any concessions to the striking masses, while at the same time, they are funding bank bailouts and vast military budgets to fuel the war that NATO is waging against Russia in Ukraine. According to Euronews, households across Europe are struggling to pay bills as the cost of living crisis bites and leads to street protests in many countries. It started with energy, but the cost of living crisis has now spread to all sectors and is affecting all of Europe and further afield. The problem has many components, but the one that most concerns political leaders and affects households the most is food price inflation. In February, gas prices in Europe fell to their lowest level in almost 18 months. However, food prices are continuing their upward trend. Also, Wall Street Journal, in its recent article, wrote, "It just had an energy crisis. Now Europe faces a food shock." Wall Street Journal stressed food prices continue to rise at a rapid pace, surprising central banks and pressuring debt-laden governments across Europe. Meanwhile, Bloomberg reported Brexit has weakened the UK economy and driven the nation into a sort of geriatric decline. British financier and chairman of the private equity firm Terra Firma told Bloomberg recently that since the UK left the European Union, it has been competing on the world stage, but the country's current laws are not suitable for the new environment. Billionaire Guy Hens suggested in the outlet's weekly Industries podcast. Unless change happens, the UK risks becoming poorer compared to other European countries. He said, "I'll look at the UK and see that in 2030, Poland will be wealthier than we are. In 2040, we will be the poor man in Europe." According to Hans, the UK should not have left the EU, as the country needs rule of law and consistency, but not a single politician is talking about going back. He lamented that Brexit has essentially thrown the country back 50 years to the 1970s, a decade that is widely remembered as the time of crisis, with a skyrocketing inflation, high unemployment, strikes, and power cuts. According to Bloomberg, the enormous amount of political change that has happened in the UK over the past 7 years has left investors concerned and the public lacking confidence, the billionaires believe. Now that the UK is out of the EU, the British government could take a radical approach and change some of its laws, Hans said, citing the country's extraordinary complex labor laws that are a nightmare compared to other European countries. The UK also needs some boring bookkeeping, and the current Prime Minister Rishi Sunak seems to be good at it, according to Hens. The financier noted that the British government has succeeded in repairing some of the damage caused by Liz Truss, whose economic policies were absolutely disastrous and would have led the country needing a bailout. Truss' argument, however, that the UK needed to become much more productive to be more competitive was 100% right.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, training kids to be confidant. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of training kids to be confident and keep secrets in the Islamic lifestyle. It is very important that when we are raising kids, when we are training our children, and when we are raising them up, we teach them the ethics. And one of the most important ethical thing which is related to our daily life or the Islamic life is that our kids, they keep the secrets. They learn how to keep secrets. And they are confident. They when we tell them something or when they know about someone, they keep those secrets. We know that in the childhood we have seen when kids are playing to each other, they keep complaining about each other, they keep telling the things that they're doing. So we need to stop kids from doing this because it will have effect on their personality. And their personality, rather raising as someone who can keep the secrets, who is confident, rather it becomes someone who keeps telling everyone about the things. And, you know, sometimes we have kids who talk a lot. They have this habit of talking a lot and keep complaining about things. If we want to avoid such a thing, then obviously we need to raise them in a way that they keep the secrets. And why is it important? It is important because it is making their personality. Their personality should be in a way that they keep the secrets and they look a person who is trustworthy. So in order to be a trustworthy person, in order to be someone who is serious in his life, who takes things seriously, and he does not leak the secrets or, you know, tell the secrets of the others or maybe anything that he has said. For example, we want our kids not to be the backbiters. So the very first thing is to teach them how to keep secrets, inshallah, and the importance of this. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of raising our kids by telling them to be secretful or training our kids to be confident. Now, in order to raise them, in order to train them to be confident or to be trustworthy, it is important to talk about the importance of it. And what are the reasons that people, they leak the secrets? The people, if they are not trustworthy, what are the reasons? And if our children know about those reasons and we have trained them well, obviously they will avoid these things in their life. And the very first thing is that people who are talkative, they cannot keep secrets. So we need to stop our kids from being someone who is talkative. And yes, I know that sometimes we want them to be talkative so that they build their it builds their confidence. But this talkative should be in a way that wherever it is necessary, they talk there. They don't fear of speaking about something. They don't fear talking with the people or socializing with the people. But if someone is too much talkative, it cannot keep the secrets because it's his habit or the person's habit is to talk. And when they talk, during talking, they leak the secrets as well. They tell everything that they know because they want to talk. On the other hand, the second thing, which is the factor that the people, they cannot be the trustworthy, is where people want to show off themselves. You know, when they want to show off themselves, they tell everything like, I know this and I know this. Why do they do this? It's because they want to show that I'm someone and they're showing off. So therefore, these two things are the initial things that we should avoid. We should train our kids in a way that they avoid to be talkative and they avoid to be someone who shows off, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Since the beginning of the Ukraine conflict, Moscow has been making claims about the existence of a vast network of secret U.S.-funded biological laboratories in Ukraine, and since then has repeatedly released a series of documents on the matter. The U.S. government has confirmed the existence of these laboratories in March of last year, but claimed that they do not pursue military goals. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia's Sputnik News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. Lieutenant General Igor Krylov, the head of the Radiation, Chemical and Biological Defense Troops of the Russian Armed Forces, said on Friday, 27th of May, the data obtained by the Russian Defense Ministry once again proves that the United States is developing biological weapons on the territory of Ukraine. Lieutenant General Igor Krylov told reporters, "The U.S. Defense Ministry, the Pentagon is actively studying these economically significant infections outside the national territory in biological laboratories located along the border of its geopolitical opponents. This once again confirms that the United States is developing biological weapons components outside of national jurisdiction, including on the territory of Ukraine." Lieutenant General Igor Krylov added, "Russian Defense Ministry specialists have seized documents from an Askania Nova Biosphere Reserve Laboratory, confirming that the Kharkov Institute of Experimental and Clinical Veterinary Medicine have worked on military biological projects for the Pentagon." Lieutenant General Krylov said, "Documents seized from a veterinary laboratory of the reserve confirm the involvement of the Kharkov Institute in the work within the framework of U.S. projects, the U-PI-8, PI-444, and preparation for implementation of the Flu-Fly-Way project." The official stated the projects aim at evaluating the conditions under which the transmission of pathogens of economically significant infections can become uncontrollable, cause economic damage, and create food security risks. Lieutenant General Igor Krylov added, "The rising incidence of bird flu in Russia raises concern against the background of a mass death of birds due to biological experiments in Ukraine in 2021. The official said the ministry has already drawn attention to the documented fact of a mass death of birds on the territory of the Askania Nova Nature Reserve in 2021, which according to experts was an infectious nature. He added, "The simultaneous death of birds was provoked by ongoing experiments and neglect of safety requirements." Lieutenant General Krylov told reporters, "A task force of Russian Defense Ministry, together with employees of the Federal Security Service and the Rosselhoznadzor, or Russian Agriculture Safety Watchdog, confirmed the facts of the collection and certification of strains of bird flu virus that have a high epidemic potential and are able to overcome the interspecies barrier, in particular the H5N8 strain, the lethality of which, when transmitted to humans, can reach as high as 40%. Additionally, Lieutenant General Krylov said Ukraine tried to destroy biomaterials left in an Askania Nova Biosphere Reserve biolaboratory But Russian military scientists managed to identify traces of highly pathogenic bird flu virus there. Lieutenant General Kirillov stressed that the fact indicate that the United States viewed Ukraine as a foothold for deployment of NATO contingents. The official said the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research supervised the UPI-1 and UPI-2 military biological projects, during which an active collection of biomaterials from the population of Ukraine was carried out. The TASS news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The documents obtained by the Russian Defense Ministry confirmed the participation of the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in the study of antibiotic resistance of microorganisms isolated from the Ukrainian military during the hostilities in Donbas region from 2014 to 2020. During a recent press briefing, Lieutenant General Igor Krylov, the head of the Radiation, Chemical and Biological Defense Troops of the Russian Armed Forces, asked, why should the Institute of the United States Army study the drug resistance of microorganisms isolated on the territory of Donbas? This is another evidence that the United States considered the territory of Ukraine as a springboard for deployment of NATO military contingents. Additionally, the documents obtained during special operations revealed that for several years the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research of the U.S. Army trained Ukrainian personnel under the Biological Threat Reduction Program. Lieutenant General Krylov said, the documents obtained during the special operation indicate that for several years the Walter Reed Research Institute participated in the training of Ukrainian personnel as part of the Biological Threat Reduction Program. The Walter Reed Research Institute of the U.S. Army is a basic part of the Pentagon's Electronic Integrated Disease Surveillance System, or EIDSS. The official emphasized the United States is setting long-term goals to find military applications of biotechnology to outrun strategic rivals. Lieutenant General Krylov told reporters the document, the 2023 U.S. Biomanufacturing Strategy, defines long-term goals for the development of biotechnologies and the search for their military applications. He added, the goal declared in the strategy is to ensure technological sovereignty in the field of biomanufacturing and overtake strategic rivals. Lieutenant General Igor Krylov stressed that the United States has never clearly stated its obligations in the field of safety in the military biological research. Lieutenant General Krylov told the briefing, it should be noted that the United States has never clearly stated its obligations in the field of safety of research conducted in biological laboratories under its control. The official highlighted that the United States is improving methods of biological protection of its military personnel while simultaneously studying pathogens of particularly dangerous diseases typical for specific areas. Lieutenant General Igor Krylov said, I will remind you that in October of 2022, the United States unveiled a national strategy to counter biological threats. The document has a doctrinal nature and defines biological risk management as the U.S.'s vital priority. The official added, the United States has planned work to collect pathogens of specially dangerous infections in Central Asia and in the South Caucasus region under the guise of humanitarian cooperation. Lieutenant General Igor Krylov said, under the guise of solving purely peaceful tasks in the states of Central Asia and in the Transcaucasus, the United States has planned work to select and genotype samples of pathogens of especially dangerous infections endemic to these regions. Plague, anthrax, tularemia. At the same time, the U.S. administration uses the already worked-out scenario of alleged humanitarian interaction. He specified that for these operations, the United States government resorts to using not military but civilian organizations, for example, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and the Griffon Scientific Research Company. English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Here is a part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with Iranian commanders and senior military officials in the Imam Khomeini Hosseini on April 16, 2023. The second point is that you must follow up on the things you have started. Now suppose, for example, that you start building a certain number of houses. Very well, but one of the problems with the plans for construction in our country is that it often takes longer than the required assigned time. Let's say, for example, that a house complex is to be finished in 3 years. You should not allow it to take 7 or 10 years. This is also one of my recommendations. I've written down a few things to share with you, my dear brothers. One is about your position. When Imam Ali alayhi salam writes a letter to Malik al-Ashtar saying, the army is, by the will of God, the fortress of the subjects. Nahj al-Balagha, letter 53. This means that you are the fortress. You are a fence for the nation and for the society. That is a great honor. What honor is greater than that? Imam Ali alayhi salam describes the armed forces as being strong fence around the country and nation. What else is greater or more important than this?
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Consider how valuable your action is when you take care of one person and are a place of refuge for him or her. Now compare this to an entire nation. You accept to protect a nation, so this is a very high position. It is a big position, and accordingly, it brings with it great responsibilities. Just like everything that is valuable, the responsibility that it brings is in proportion to the value. So appreciate your value, the value of this work, the value of this job, the value of this responsibility, and truly accept the responsibilities. In other words, shoulder the burden of this responsibility and take action in this regard. Another point is that, fortunately, our armed forces are making progress. All the looked-for indices show this. This is not to say that we don't have any flaws. Yes, there is no doubt that we have certain flaws and weaknesses. But what's important is that we are moving forward. That is definite. There is no stopping. There is progress. This is a very important point. Don't miss this point. Stopping is like moving backwards. There is no difference.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Resistance Festival in Brussels has gathered Palestinian rights campaigners from across Belgium and beyond. Israel's murder of innocent civilians and the regime's ongoing illegal activities in the occupied territories has been highlighted.
The Nakba has been going for three quarters of a century now, and we're talking about brutal colonialism and occupation in its most ugly form imaginable. Yeah, people are angry.
Apartheid, ethnic cleansing, segregation, siege, all forms of ethnic cleansing and colonialism. The Palestinian political prisoners also.
Tel Aviv authorities continue to destroy Palestinian homes and develop stolen land for settlers. Activists are calling on everyone living in the EU to stop buying Israeli products.
Yes, I think there should be boycotts, I think there should be sanctions, I think there should be punishment.
I think it's absolutely vital that we continue to support them in their struggle against fascism and imperialism.
We are here, helpless and hopeless sometimes. We feel we cannot protect our people in Gaza. This is painful, very painful.
Even though the United Nations classifies Israel's activities as illegal under international law, the EU seems to suggest that both sides are to blame for the occupation.
We are consistently urging all parties to exercise maximum restraint and not to contribute to escalation, but to the contrary.
When it comes to the war in Ukraine, there is no such mixed messaging from the EU. Russia has always been the only aggressor, end of story. Rights campaigners say Palestinians will be free eventually, insisting it's simply a matter of time. Given that the European Union is so willing to impose sanctions when it falls in line with the wishes of the United States, those gathered here are calling on EU leaders to finally muster some courage and put Israel under real pressure. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Do
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has won another term, garnering 52.16% of the vote. Right after the announcement of the runoff results Sunday night, opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu thanked the 25 million Turkish citizens who voted for him, especially youth and women, and promised to continue the struggle for democracy with his alliance.
The means of the state has been entirely pledged to one person. I could never stay silent when your rights were violated. I could never tolerate you becoming second-class citizens after millions of refugees came here. I fought for all this and I will continue to fight.
For her part, Good Party leader Meral Akşener congratulated President Erdogan on winning a new term and called her supporters and those who cast their vote in favor of the opposition candidate not to feel pessimism or loss, assuring that election is the most fundamental display of democracy.
Don't forget that we are still here at the parliament. We will continue to fulfill our responsibility. I want to congratulate Mr. Erdogan for being elected, but he should not forget that the polls conveyed messages to him as well.
Akşener delivered her speech from the Good Party headquarters in Ankara, rather than the area opposition alliance designated to celebrate their victory in the case of winning. Analysts believe the only reason those six political parties agreed to nominate one candidate despite their ideological differences is to gather their efforts and oust Erdogan. And with that not achieved, the nation alliance is likely to be divided.
I think in the coming few days we may see divisions and resignations in the Turkish opposition, especially that the table of six gathered to unseat President Erdogan. On the other hand, I think the People Alliance and ruling AK Party will be facing a lot of challenges because Turkey is already struggling with economic crisis, the refugee crisis and some problems with the neighboring countries. The People Alliance must work harder now that they will govern the country.
More than 25 million Turkish citizens voted for opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. This election had been seen as Erdogan's biggest challenge, for the Nation Alliance was very close to unseating him. Now that the presidential run is over, political parties have already started preparing for the upcoming local election in 2024, with Erdogan promising his supporters a win in both opposition strongholds, the capital Ankara and the economic hub, Istanbul. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, the Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards nonviolent protesters. Many of France's yellow vests were glad the subject was reported upon. But the group which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the Yellow Vests have been in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make our legitimate demands for democratic and economic rights, and we won't stop until we get them.
Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 Yellow Vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries.
The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely, and will likely scare many away from even observing a yellow vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy, why the yellow vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a 2-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
Pour leur physique de venir en manifestation.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest now. There are so many arrests.